There had been witchcraft accusations before. There had been outbreaks of witchcraft before. Never before had there been this kind of prosecution where no one who walked into that courtroom exited innocent.
Welcome to Witch Hunt. I'm Josh Hutchinson, but you can also call me Excited. We get to talk about Salem today.
And I'm Sarah Jack. In this episode, we are joined by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Stacey Schiff.
Schiff is the author of 6 books, including The Witches, Suspicion, Betrayal, and Hysteria in 1692 Salem.
In this exciting conversation, Stacey clears up some major misconceptions about the witch hunt
and reviews many of the theories that have been proposed to explain what started the witch hunt.
And you're about to hear the factors that really did shape the witch hunt.
And we'll learn about many significant actors, including Tituba, in this conversation with discussion of the roles that they played.
It was such a treat to get to hear about her research process and approach to making historical events so understandable.
Together, we reflect on key lessons from the Salem witch hunt.
Welcome, Stacey Schiff, Pulitzer Prize-winning author known for her compelling narratives and deep research into historical events and figures. Her notable works include The Witches, Suspicion, Betrayal, and Hysteria in 1692 Salem. What are some major misconceptions people have about the Salem witch trials?
Oh my goodness, it's a long and distinguished list, isn't it? I think generally people tend to assume that people burned, not hanged. So I think that's the first one. I think the general assumption is that all the victims were women. But as we know, 5 men were also victims that year. They were not universally poor women. They were not older women. There was a 5-year-old who was accused as well. Because I think we take a lot of what we understand to have been the history from Arthur Miller, I think we have assumed that voodoo and naked dancing in the forest were part of it, and that's taken from The Crucible, either the play or the movie, not from the actual events of 1692. And I think the word Salem is slightly misleading because 25 communities wind up being involved in any case, not only the town of Salem. And I guess the biggest misconception is that there were witches, of which there were none.
And what are some of the theories about how the Salem witch hunt happened?
I think that the epidemic that year, the panic that year, has been pretty much written down to anything you can possibly think of, from regional hostilities to class conflict to tensions within the church to food poisoning to teenage hysteria to fraud to taxes, political instability, trauma due to the frontier with the Native Americans, the weather. You could go mad actually staring at the events and trying to pick a pattern. As with all things, if you're really looking for a pattern, you could almost always find one, which is something of a key to what happens that year. So I think many of those things have been applied and then discarded. And I think we can get into this. One of the issues, of course, with that year is that so many forces come into play that it isn't predominantly actually one thing. There isn't a key, as much as we would like for there to be one. There isn't a key to the Salem witch epidemic of that year.
And how did you manage to clarify the true causes behind the witch trials? You made them so easy to understand for the readers, despite the reputation for the mystery and the complexity.
Well, thanks, Sarah. That's a lovely way to put it. I hope it's clear. I think what I did is that when I started the research, I read through all of the paper that survives. And it's about 1,000 pages of, as the court papers are missing, but we have about 1,000 pages of arrest documents or depositions or jailers accounting. We have about 1,000 pages of paper. And I read through all of that and tried to make that material really speak for itself in some way, because you can see the story mutating from beginning to end. What initially passes for witchcraft when the first girls are afflicted is not what will be discussed as witchcraft by late summer, when this thing has really snowballed to just tremendous effect. So you can begin to tease out who's carrying the narrative and how the narrative twists and turns and what the sources of that are. And I guess to that end, I would cite 2 things. I went back and I read all 8 or 9, I can't remember any longer, volumes of the records and files of the Quarterly Courts of Essex County, which is not, it's to the years prior to 1692, but it is a complete record of all of the, these are very litigious people. These are all of the collisions in court that all of these families had over these years. And the same issues and the same names come up as you will later see in some of the witchcraft accusations. So that was almost like a template to both the sensibility and the history of these people. It's interesting that about half of the women who hang had been accused previously of witchcraft. There's obviously some lingering resentment or some lingering questions here. And then the other, from a textual point of view, the other great guide was the writings of Cotton Mather, the minister who's at the young minister who is at the center of the trials, and who had written a bestseller in which he had incorporated an account of the European witchcraft, a Swedish witchcraft panic of years earlier, which infiltrates the New England drinking water and which bears a mark on Salem. There's actually, I think, a great doctoral thesis to be written about this because he imports elements from Sweden that had never before been seen in any kind of New England witchcraft testimony. That's a long answer to your extremely good question, but that was how I began to decode it. You can see, I read all of the sermons that the girls would have heard that year, and you can see bits and pieces of that sermon in their testimony. You can see that they're recycling the imagery that they've heard on Sundays.
And what were some of the factors which actually did lead to the Salem witch trials?
I guess the chief one, this is an overdetermined event. It's very hard, as I said, to tease one thing or another thing out. I would say more than anything, the question that year becomes not what was afflicting these young women, but why was the court so intent on prosecution? Because there had been witchcraft accusations before, there had been outbreaks of witchcraft before. Never before had there been this kind of prosecution where no one who walked into that courtroom exited innocent. And for that, I would say that it was something of the political environment, which makes that year stand apart. You have on this court a group of men who, for reasons of their own, given political instability of the previous few years, need to prove they are a law and order administration. And in particular, the Chief Justice of the court, who has been something of a political, he's been very ambidextrous politically, he's played both sides repeatedly, needs to prove that he is solely in command and is not going to relax his hold. And he is the one who's pushing, it's very clear to us, he's the one who's pushing for convictions. So I think the politics is something that we haven't necessarily paid enough attention to in the past. I think, as I said, some of those earlier accusations, some of that sense of suspicion that had never really been dissipated before. And you really do have a community that's very much under fire. Salem Village, which is where the first girls begin to show signs of some sort of affliction of some disorder, is a village that has had serious trouble with its ministers. And in different ways, all of those prior ministers will play a role in what happens this year. But the minister in whose household the witchcraft, so to speak, breaks out, is under siege with his community. He's at war with his parishioners, and he's very much driving these events forward in some ways.
Were there any other primary actors who caused the witch trials to proceed as they did? And if you're interested in following that with what halted the witch trials.
So yeah, I think you could probably draw something of a schematic if you wanted to just take like the, how does this thing snowball? What are the bases it has to hit to produce this storm of accusations? And I think this household under siege, obviously it's a hothouse environment. You have these girls living in a situation where they can see that their father and uncle is in disfavor with the community. So there's a sense of an explosion within that household. One of the first people accused, as you know, is Tituba, the Indian slave in the household. And Tituba's testimony is so vivid and so kaleidoscopic and so convincing that once she, that and moreover, she establishes, she's one of the three first accused who says, yes, witchcraft was at work. Yes, I flew on a pole to Boston with my accomplices. And moreover, I saw these spectral cats, crazy testimony. Once she has established in the eyes of the community that witchcraft has been at work, it's very hard for anybody to reverse course. So that's another sort of post on the way. And then one of the first girls who testifies, a teenager named Abigail Hobbs, who's the bad girl of Topsfield, she then spreads the accusations out beyond Salem Village because she suddenly points a finger toward a former minister of the town and of the village, in fact. And so there you begin to see that the thing has tentacles and it begins to spread beyond the immediate household. And then I guess I should add, actually, Thomas Putnam, one of the villagers, who has had a run of terrible luck and who will complain against, I think, 35 of the ultimate accused witches, and who will file the first charges. He does something as well to help this thing explode. And then from the other side, you have the head of the witchcraft court, Stoughton, and you have Cotton Mather, who's always in the background, trying very hard to help advise the court, but always in a way that seems to press them toward prosecution. As much as he's pretending to be even-handed, he seems quite intent on somehow exorcising this ill and purifying the community. So you have these other forces that are both massaging the narrative and enforcing the prosecution. It's hard to say what single element shuts down the prosecution. A number of things happen, and I think the timing is crucial as well. The witchcraft breaks out in late January, early February. The trials take place largely over the summer. And by fall, the accusations have begun to spread in every direction. We've got to the point where it is far easier to accuse someone else or to confess than it is to claim your innocence. And so obviously in that situation, the snowballing is out of control. It's also, however, the fall, which is traditionally the season when you wanted to make sure that you had plenty of stores in your cellar and you were ready for the winter. And so the interest in spending all day in witchcraft courtrooms tended to wane a little bit. So it may be that a healthy dose of skepticism begins to creep in for practical reasons. It's also true that the newly appointed, newly installed Massachusetts governor is not a Puritan. He doesn't buy into these trials the way the other authorities had. And he reaches out late that year to the New York ministers to get their opinion on what's happening in Salem. And that's the first attempt to go beyond the kind of monolith, which is the New England establishment. And their opinion is very different from what the judges in Massachusetts are hearing. So you get this outside opinion as well. And slowly but surely, you get people in the community, and Thomas Brattle would be the best instance of this. He's a 35-year-old Boston merchant who doesn't have any relationship to any of the other well-born justices, which is unusual because they are a very inbred, familiar group one to the other, and who realizes that basically, if someone gives testimony with her eyes closed, she's not observing what's happening. She's imagining something and sees that a great miscarriage of justice is taking place and will be very hard to erase from history. And very quietly, and in fact, anonymously, he writes a small pamphlet about the court's proceedings. And he is one of two voices. There's a Boston minister as well, also very quietly, who will begin to speak up against the trials. And it may be that at that point, the accusations have just reached a very high level and too many important people have been implicated. It may just be that it begins to stretch the imagination. At first, there had been 5 witches and then there had been 10 witches and suddenly there were 500 witches. And it may be, it's as if suddenly everyone awoke from this great delirium is what it does begin to feel like. Even at that juncture, there are two things that are interesting. One is that Stoughton, the Chief Justice, is unwilling to shut down the court, and he has to be forced to shut down the court because he's convinced still of his rectitude and of the court's probity in prosecuting. And secondly, and this I think is something we tend to lose sight of, the belief in witchcraft will persist well after the trials. People believe that they themselves were innocent or that the accused that year were innocent, but they don't yet lose their faith in witchcraft. It's an interesting thing where the trials end, but there is still this lingering sense that there was something supernatural at work.
And there's still a lot of supernatural explanations for Salem. Sarah was talking to somebody the other day who was asking, did they have powers?
When you begin to read the testimony in court, I don't know if you all have household mysteries the way we do, but the kitchen scissors always goes missing. Who's got the kitchen scissors? You begin to realize how much can be explained by witchcraft. It's such an elastic and versatile definition. And especially in a world where you didn't have science, where you couldn't explain illness, where weather was not something you could understand, much less control, where things seemed to happen in the night, where there was a lot of drinking, by the way, where the dark was very dark, where you had Native Americans or people with whom you had conflicts at your doorstep, you can see how this would be the perfect cauldron in which to dissolve your questions.
How should Titibus station in life and experiences, especially in contrast to those of the Puritan women, inform our understanding of her role in the witch trials?
Three women are initially accused, and they are the three most obvious women one would have chosen. One is a woman who's homeless. One is a woman who'd been who had sued multiple times and was in disfavor in the community. And the third was Titipa, who's the household slave. And who would have had more? She's the only one of the three, as I said, who actually confesses that she is involved in something satanic, and would have had more reason, obviously, than either of the other two women to give these men in authority what they were looking for. It's really clear when you look at the papers how much these young women in particular, how much all the youngsters really were cowed by these men in authority. These were the most eminent men in town. They lived in the most beautiful homes. They dressed with the greatest of fashion. And their authority would have been something very difficult to resist for anyone, but much less someone who was a slave. Titipa has every reason to cough up this extraordinary tale about yellow birds and flying cats and flying off to Boston on a pole. She makes it very clear that the devil has said that if she talked about this, he would slice off her head. So she sounds like she's terrified of something anyway. And that testimony possibly was beaten out of her. But even if it wasn't beaten out of her, there's one hint that perhaps it may have been. Those men knew what they were about to hear because there were at least three people sitting in the room that day waiting for her to testify. So they knew that this was the gold mine, that she was going to be the witness who was going to make this thing real. It's very hard to believe she would have had any grounds with which to resist them, given her station in life.
Very true. And I have to fess up that my great-grandfather, Joseph Hutchinson, was one who filed the complaint along with Thomas Putnam.
I love that. Wait, are you related to Thomas Hutchinson too?
No, there's different. Salem Hutchinsons and Boston Hutchinsons. Okay. And so far, genetically, nobody's found a DNA connection between the two. Anyways, what key lessons should be learned from the Salem witch hunt and applied today?
I suppose we should avoid jumping to conclusions. This is what happens when fear paralyzes reason and when we overcorrect and sort of overanalyze. And I guess what the best that could be said for this real mishap, this tragedy, is that it should serve as a sort of vaccine for us all. We have this instance in our record. We should be looking at it and using it when we think we might be heading in this direction so we don't end up with McCarthyism, basically. We've seen this, we've seen the dynamic so vividly so often. And it is so clearly where you end up going if you head down the road of conspiratorial thinking. This is the end of the road. And as early as really Thomas Brattle's writings that year, people were very aware of the fact that this was something that was going to be a stain on history and that was going to be there, a blinking red light or a guardrail for future times, which is indeed how we should be looking at it. It's always been interesting to me. It's very much in line with Richard Hofstadter's paranoid style in American politics, but it doesn't figure in that book. But it really is the beginning of that, this the overheated rhetoric and the need, this tribal need to prosecute in some way, and the inability to basically defer to reason when you realize that the reasonable is actually the right solution. Somehow the complicated answer seems somehow like the more appealing answer often.
I wanted to talk a little bit about how you brought out some really strong themes in your book, like the darkness or the tension between people's expectations and disappointments with each other. How did you draw those out into the forefront of your book?
I don't know that I have an exact answer for you. I think what was important to me was to get beyond the theory. I wanted the reader to feel something of what it was like to be in New England in the 17th century. And that is why the darkness became such an obsession of mine, because so much of the testimony is based on a man trying to find his way home from the inn at night and being unable to maneuver through the trees. And therefore, assuming the trees have moved, not that he might have had a few too many drinks earlier himself, but that the darkness is just constant and a sort of disability almost to everyone. So I wanted to bypass the theory at the early end of the book, leave all the explanations to the end, which may or may not have been successful, but just to plunge the reader immediately into what it felt like. that's why the book begins with Anne Foster, who, and I think I read fairly early on of Anne Foster, who's this older Andover farm woman who testifies in court under oath to the fact that she flew through the air on a pole, and moreover, not only flew through the air on a pole, but crash landed. I wanted the reader to think, what would possess a person to swear to that under oath? How could you be so certain that this had happened and even tell the authorities about the cheese and bread you had put in your pocket before your flight? So I just wanted to literally plunge right into that New England feel and into this, into where, how a person could wind up believing that of herself, or at least believing that if she swore to that, she was telling the truth.
On the flying, you had mentioned the Swedish witch trials before. And is the flying, did that come from Sweden?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked, because I should have mentioned that, Joshua. Yes, there had never, witches in New England had never flown before 1692. So there were two things that were new. Basically, the whole, and I should have gone back to mention this, the whole question of what was a witch. A witch was basically a devil's accomplice whose target wasn't your body, but your soul. She or he was there to do the devil's work with her little menagerie of helpers, who were generally cats and dogs and toads and all the diabolical creatures we can imagine. But the idea of a pact with the devil was very much an Anglo-Saxon concept, while the idea of a witch being able to fly to do her business was not. That was a continental witch. And continental witches tended to be much more exotic creatures. They engaged in all kinds of sexual acts. Puritan witches never engaged in sexual acts. And they did not have, Anglo-Saxon witches did not have a satanic Sabbath. That too was a continental idea. So both the flying and the satanic Sabbath came to New England, it seems to me, through the writings of Cotton Mather, who wrote about that Swedish outbreak of witchcraft, which almost completely parallels what happens in Salem down to the ages of the first children who are afflicted, and with very similar results, in fact, in that innocents die. But those two concepts were something that were entirely foreign to previous, both the lore of witchcraft in New England and to previous witchcraft testimony.
Having written extensively on various historical figures and events, how does your latest project, the revolutionary Samuel Adams, compare to your other works in terms of research challenges or thematic focus and the narrative approach you take?
That's a big question, Sarah. To start with the thematic piece, there's a funny footnote in a way with the American Revolution in that Salem lives on. And that's an interesting thing with Salem generally, is to see how it then gets recycled and used by different parts of the country. Abolitionists will end up saying that basically slavery is on par with essentially hanging witches. And pro-slavery people in the South will basically point to New England and say abolition is on par with, and they'll say the opposite. So both sides will end up going back to cite Salem witchcraft. But in the run-up to the revolution, as Stamp Act protests and other protests take off, an extraordinary number of people compare the moment to the delusion of 1692. So you get this constant drumbeat of things that there has never been this much unrest, there has never been such a delusion, people have never been so mad since the bedlam of 1692. And it's just funny to see that there's a comparison between Stamp Act protests and trying witches in the court in Salem Town. From a research point of view, I was at a great loss, because although there are things missing from the Salem record, Samuel Adams' papers are very incomplete. He destroyed a lot of paper because he needed to destroy his trail, because he's obviously fomenting revolution. So there's a no fingerprints school at work here. And I was working from a somewhat mutilated record for that reason. So that was a big challenge, and a challenge that I ended up filling by reading a lot in the archives in London, which are essentially what his enemies were saying about him. So he would never claim credit, for example, for some misdeed, some street protest or street ambush. But you can be certain that the customs commissioners in Boston or the lieutenant governor in Boston was writing back to London saying, let me tell you what this rascal Samuel Adams is up to this week. So I ended up being able to fill in a certain amount of his whereabouts and his machinations from the other side, with a grain of salt, I should add. And there was a great deal, I think this is a big difference between the two, there's a great deal of Adams in the newspapers, because he's writing constantly for the Boston newspapers. And one of the reasons the revolution takes off as it does from Boston is because there are so many newspapers and such a literate populace. And that, in a funny way, is a fallout from something that was true in 1692, you didn't have newspapers in 1692, but you did have a highly literate populace because in order to pray, you needed to know how to read. And it is in a funny way that very erudition that fuels the Salem witch epidemic, because people have bought into this library of books, which Cotton Mather brings to the forefront, and which these men are consulting. And so they have these shelves of literature on witchcraft. What they don't have are the skeptical texts on witchcraft, because those had been banned from coming into Boston. So in a funny way, you have a case of too much erudition. But anyway, it's that literate tradition, which flows obviously from one book to the other.
And Cotton Mather, ironically, spurred a lot of the activity on by writing about the other events. So you have the Swedish trials and the Goodwin case, and they're all feeding into the behaviors of these afflicted people. So Cotton was involved from the beginning, I suppose.
It's funny, the court appeals to him, I think, three times. I'm now forgetting, but I think it's three times. And three times he basically says, you need to go very carefully. You need to exercise exquisite caution. And then he adds, nevertheless, I would vote for a speedy and vigorous prosecution. And there's always that nevertheless attached to each of his statements. And after the trials, there's a document, and I no longer remember if it's 1694, if it's later, where he talks about how essentially the trials had done good because they had filled the pews and they had awakened a sluggish generation to its faith. And really, nobody who mattered had been lost in the process. It's not a statement that had been meant for public consumption, but it tells you something of how the establishment viewed both the victims and the prosecution.
It's remarkable.
How do you hope your books impact reader understanding of history and its relevance to the present?
I call the trials a kind of vaccine. I like to think this is something of which we don't lose sight so that we do not repeat this kind of demented behavior. But generally, on a sort of happier front, I like to think that there's something about biography that allows one to open the window to history from a more personal point of view, in other words, through the sensibility of the individual in question, so that if you can see something like the strains and the tensions in the family of someone like Samuel Adams, you can begin to understand why someone would feel so deeply wed to American rights and privileges and so deeply sensitive to British overreach, and therefore begin to publish the kind of supposedly seditious statements that he publishes, and really spearhead what becomes a revolution, why this cause becomes so very vital to him. And you don't really understand that if you don't really understand sort of the personal history that goes behind it. And I think we lose that sometimes when we talk about history from a higher altitude. I think when you're seeing it through the sensibility of one person, whether that person is Cleopatra or Samuel Adams, you begin to understand those forces better.
And what subjects or events are you drawn to explore next? Is there anything that you can tell us about?
I am working on a new book. Interestingly or not, it's actually a return to a subject, something I've never done before. It's another book about Benjamin Franklin. And this time it's about, the previous time I had written about the almost 9 years that Franklin spends in France soliciting aid and guns and men for the revolution. And he comes home in 1785 from that stint and will die in 1790. So this is a book which is going to tell the story of his life through those last five Philadelphia years. So it's really sort of the finale. It's Franklin's last act in a way.
I'm looking forward to that.
Thank you. So am I. I'm looking forward to having it, doing on the other side of it.
Thank you for your work in your book, but your work today too. Getting this information out and dissecting it like this is just really key for the world. So I know it sounds dramatic, but it
no,
is.
No, it's not. The one thing we didn't talk about, and to your point, is the silence that descends after this wipeout, right? Because for a generation, nobody would talk about it. Exoneration was impossible because people were unwilling even to admit that they were related to victims of the trials. So you, even in those first attempts at getting reparations for families in 1711, families avoiding the word witchcraft. It's basically, I lost my relative in the recent unpleasantness is essentially what they're saying. And that whole sort of cushion of shame and regret that falls and guilt that descends on the scene afterwards means that so much has been lost to us, right? So much of the history has been lost to us. So much of the record goes missing because everyone just wanted to pretend this had never happened. And I guess that's why when we're saying this is really crucial for us to bring back to the forefront, there's your reason.
And now for Minute with Mary.
Let me update you about female Gleason. We found that Susanna, wife of Thomas Gleason, all the records were found proving she lived at Cambridge in 1665 when she was supposed to have been accused for witchcraft. However, the author who listed a female Gleason accused for witchcraft in their book did not cite their source. We have reached out to that author who has yet to respond. However, our team didn't stop. Contact was made with both the Massachusetts State Archives and the Judicial Archives. These archivists exhausted all their resources and could not locate any document tying an accusation to any woman with the surname Gleason. Therefore, until we hear from this author, it can be declared as of this recording that no woman named Gleason was ever accused of witchcraft who lived at Cambridge, Massachusetts, or in any surrounding town. This is why looking at the original source or primary document is so important. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
Sarah has End Witch Hunts News.
End Witch Hunts News. We want to extend our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you for your unwavering support for this growing nonprofit. Your monetary donations and the invaluable time you've dedicated as volunteers have been pivotal in fueling the growth of our vital projects. It's through your contributions of time and money that we're able to continue our mission, bringing to light critical lessons from history and fostering a deeper acknowledgement of witch hunting today. Your involvement not only aids in amplifying this history, but also in ensuring that the lessons derived from it resonate far, wide, and clearly. Thank you for being an integral part of our journey and for your commitment to helping us make a meaningful impact worldwide. Your engagement is what makes all of this possible, and we're immensely grateful for the community we've built together. We're thrilled to announce the upcoming Salem 101 series on Witch Hunt podcasts. This original series is a comprehensive deep dive into the Salem witch trials. Written by Josh Hutchinson, also known as @SalemWitchHunt on social media, each episode promises to peel back the layers of this unmatched account of community betrayal, guided by the records and writings that have propelled the story to this day. Join us, Salem Witch Trial descendants, as we examine the year these events unfolded. Join us as we look closely at the fascinating individuals that many of us call ancestors. We will tackle the pressing questions that have intrigued the world, revealing insights that have led to the current understanding of the Salem Witch Trials. For those eager to broaden their knowledge, we encourage you to explore our past catalog of episodes. These recordings offer an insightful introduction to the subject and cover witch trials that predate Salem, setting the stage for this monumental series.
Thank you, Sarah.
You're welcome.
And thank you for listening to Witch Hunt.
Join us again every week.
Have a great today and a beautiful tomorrow.